The fourth sermon in a series that we are doing on what is a pastor. And this evening we are going to start with, again, we are going to look at, let's say, the eternal position of pastor. That's not my title. But that's pretty much what a pastor, once, if God has called somebody to be a pastor, that is pretty much what they become forever, is a pastor. I have a extreme dislike for the method that we use. It's not, dislike is too strong of a word, because whether I like something or not that pertains to religion makes absolutely no difference. But whether or not it is according to God's will and God's plan, rather, I should say, the system that we use of pastors in our country, where we select a person with a good personality and we put them through college and we train them to be a people person, more or less, train them to not believe the Bible, and stand them up behind the pulpit in a paid position where their paycheck depends on how well they please the people. And when they get to be 65 years old or whatever it is, they retire and spend the next however many years of life that they live traveling the country like every other person who retires. And then they live those end years is what we call the good days. That is not a pastor. In fact, in general, that position is occupied by somebody who is not saved. In general. That is not always true, because unfortunately the Church of God has a habit of always following the world in everything they do. So we have probably numerous churches around our country, around the world, who, though they be good people, and though the pastor there is even a saved and godly man, yet we pattern the way we do things after the way the world, or that is, the fake church, is doing things. Now, the fact of the matter is, I can say with almost utmost confidence that any person who is pastoring a church and getting a paycheck and walking gingerly on the people's toes so that they don't quit putting money in the offering plate and retiring when they're 65 is not God-gifted or God-called to the ministry. Maybe they might be a Christian, but they are not a pastor. What we have found the last few weeks as we've been through this is that Christ, our chief shepherd or pastor, same word, gave his life for the sheep. And the people who he has called to ministry, and this does not only apply to somebody who has the technical ministry of being a pastor, but to many, many, many other types of ministry, the people who Christ has called to minister, he has called them to follow in his steps, where they lose their life to minister to the people. They give up their own plans, they give up their own wants, they give up their own desires, they allow humanity to trample on them. Interestingly, we're not going to go to this passage tonight, but I did quote in one of the meetings. I quoted when the Apostle Paul said, "Woe is me if I preach not the gospel, for if I preach the gospel willingly, then I have a reward. But if against my will a dispensation of the gospel is committed unto me. You know what Paul went on to say in that very same chapter, just shortly after he said that? You know what he said was his reward? Does anyone remember what did Paul say was his reward? Yeah. He said his personal reward was to make the gospel free and not accept money or not ask for any money from the church in spite of the fact that it was his God-given right. That was his reward. His reward was to stand up and lead the church without pay. That was his reward. Now that is somebody who has gotten into the spirit of giving the way Christ gave. That we would look at as to be someone who is a true pastor. Once you have been called of God to take part in ministry, it is not something you choose to do anymore. It is something that God has a call on your life, and it is not something that you choose to do or choose not to do when God has called you. It is something you submit to, and it is something that becomes a part of who you are, and it is something that you will do as long as you have the ability to do. Now, that does not mean that somebody does not get old to the place that they can't actually continue in ministry the way they once did. That happens sometimes. It may happen if you're a pastor of a church that when you get to be 88 years old, you can't preach anymore. It might happen to somebody. That's not quitting the ministry, okay? That's just getting old. We have the story of George Whitefield, the last sermon he preached. The night that he died. And I never read this story myself, but my dad told it numerous times from this pulpit. So if I confuse a couple of details, you forgive me. But basically what happens was he rides into town on his horse. And he goes into the house where he is to be staying for the night. And he's sick. He is not well. He hasn't been well for a long time. But the news had come to that town that George Whitefield was coming to town. And at that time in the New England states, revival was going on, and everywhere George Whitefield went, crowds of people gathered together. And so the news came that George Whitefield had come to town, and the town gathered together at that house to hear George Whitefield preach. Now, this was an unscheduled meeting. It's funny, we can't get people to come to scheduled meetings, but this was an unscheduled meeting. The people came to get a preacher to preach to them. And George Whitefield said to the people in the house, "I can't. I can't do it." And he was going upstairs to bed, as the story goes, with a candle in his hand. And as on the way up the steps, he looked out the window and saw the people gathered around the house. And he stopped at the window and he preached until the candle burned out. And he went upstairs and that night he died. That is a God-called preacher. That is somebody who is preaching the gospel because there is souls that are dying. There are people who need help. And we have a message of salvation. Paul writes it this way, and this is my text tonight, Galatians chapter 4. Galatians chapter 4, verse 19 says, "My little children, of whom I travail in birth again, until Christ be formed in you." This is the only verse we'll read out of Galatians. You know the story in Galatians. The church had been corrupted by some Jews, not Christians, some Jews, who had come from Judea, and they had come to this church and they had told the church that they needed to be circumcised and keep the law of Moses if they wanted to be saved. And in spite of the fact that it was against the doctrine of Christianity, and it cut up the doctrine of salvation through Christ. In spite of this fact, the church was accepting the doctrine. And Paul writes a very emotional letter to them, the book of Galatians, explaining to them that salvation through Christ and salvation through circumcision could not exist together. It is impossible to seek justification through the law and be saved through Christ. Now the fact of the matter is, he says something interesting in this verse that we're going to look at. These people had been saved. How long ago? We don't know. But perhaps a few years, likely. They've been saved. They've been baptized. A church has been formed. There's been leadership and teaching in the church. There is a group of people here who are the body of Christ. And Paul writes to them in this passage, and he says, "My little children, of whom I travail in birth again." See, the fact of the matter was, when a baby is born in real life, that's it. Once the baby comes out, the baby has been born. It's not going to be reborn again. We're not going to go back and have that experience again. The baby, when it comes out, has never done anything wrong, and mama and daddy love it very much when it first comes out. But if you had to go through that experience again after it was 5 years old, you'd refuse to because it was such a brat. It's not worth it anymore, you might say. Once the baby is born, you're done. But Paul said to the Galatians, "I'm going to do it again. We're going through birth again with you guys. Because the salvation that you received of Christ has been corrupted." Now those of you who are young and have not had a baby yet, or have not had a wife that had a baby yet, might not fully understand everything that is entailed with having a baby. But you can take anybody's word for it who has been through the experience that it is a death experience for everybody involved. Everybody that is, maybe, perhaps, but the baby. Let me tell you what happens when a girl is 9 months along and it's time for this baby to come out. The Bible uses the word travail here. There is no difference between the word travail or labor. They're the same word. When we say a woman has gone into labor, same word here as travail. This word means labor. So when a girl goes into labor, some of them are extremely lucky and it only lasts for an hour and a half. And with not much trouble, the baby is born. And some of them are kind of unlucky, and it might last for up to 48 hours. But it doesn't matter who you are. If you are a girl who has an hour and a half birth or a 48-hour birth, it doesn't matter where or anywhere in between. There's one thing that is absolutely for certain. Once in labor, it is the only thing you are going to do until the baby comes. There is nothing else. You're not cleaning the house. You might in the very beginning stages, okay? Before things really become serious, you might clean the house. But in general now, we're not going to cook. We're not going to clean. We're not going to work. We're not We're not taking the kids to the park. We're not doing anything. We're having a baby. The intensity of it all is enough to make everybody who's watching think that somebody is dying. And then, all of a sudden, after the mom has put in all the effort that a human being has the ability to put in to anything to bring this baby to birth, here comes the baby. And in Christianity, we are dealing with something that is different than a natural birth. Because in Christianity, we are dealing with two different sides of nature residing in the same human being, the flesh and the spirit. When you are born of the flesh, you are born. It's done. But when you are born again, then you are born of the spirit. And now we have the flesh and the spirit working together in the same person. And I will tell you guys, if you haven't noticed this in yourself, you've noticed it probably in your neighbors, you will fight and fight and fight and fight and fight with sin, with wrong, with the devil, with temptation, with everything you can imagine until you get to heaven. That is what the Christian life is. Because you are not just spirit. You are spirit and flesh. And the spirit fights against the flesh, and the flesh fights against the spirit. And when you decide that it is going to be your job to be the pastor, when you are going to be the one to feed the people of God, you are going to go through birth again and again and again and again and again with the same people. With the same people. We don't. You see what he said here? He doesn't say, my little children, of whom I travail in birth again for you. He says, I travail in birth again until Christ be formed in you. Can any of you guys give me a date on when that's going to happen? When does Christ get formed in, fully formed in a human being? When they see him face to face in heaven? So as we walk this earth, we struggle. We fall on our face. We sin. Some of you good people sin sometimes. And somebody who is set over God's people to lead God's people basically is adopting the job of being in labor for life. It is not something that you do on Sunday morning when you come to church. You don't come to church on Sunday morning and preach a well-organized sermon that you spent a couple of hours doing, and now you don't have to worry about this again until a week later. It is a life you adopt. When you go home on Sunday after you're done, you think about the people. You think about the issues in the church. You study the Bible. You find answers to the problems. There are answers. And that forms a problem. Because you know what? There are situations in life that we just walk away from because they get to be too difficult. But that is not the case with Christianity. If I hire somebody at my store and they don't work good and they cause trouble and don't listen to their boss and so on, we fire that person. They walk out the door never to return again. My problem is over. If we have a friend and that friend mooches off us and uses us and is hard on us and difficult to be around, we can unfriend that friend. We can do it electronically now. We can unfriend people electronically. We can send them dirty texts and tell them, don't come back to my house ever again. We can quit hanging out with that person. We can be done. If you have a child and your child grows up and is rebellious and causes trouble and irritates the younger kids and steals from you, you can kick that child out of the house and be done. We don't do that in church. Now I understand we only allow Christians in church now. So anybody who gets caught living a life of sin against Christian doctrine does get put out of the church. But somebody who is a pastor does not end their dealings at that time with that person. So anyway, we don't do that in church. If somebody is in church and they are having trouble, if they're causing trouble, if they're being trouble, if they are trouble, it doesn't matter what is wrong in their life, we know that Christ is the answer to their problem. And we know that He has the power, and we know that He has offered to fix the problem. And we work on it. 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 And guess who does the work? How many of you guys think that it is the baby who kicks his way out when birth happens? I think it is. That's how I experienced it before. No, sir. When Jesus said, I am the good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. He understood that the problem to fix problem that he was dealing with in humans, which was sin, that he had to fix, cost him his life. And he gave his life for the purpose. And we, as we follow Christ's steps and minister to people, we do the same thing with our lives. It is not free to be a pastor. You pay. You pay with your emotions. You pay with your brain. You pay with everything that you are, you give of your life to people. And you know what they do in return? I think we're going to have one more session on this yet. I haven't decided for sure. I think we may cover more of this next week. But you know what most of the time most people do with their pastor? Two things. They use him and talk bad about him. Those are the two things that people like to do with their pastor. Now, if you've ever seen little kids, you've got an exact picture of what happens in church. Only you don't believe it happens in church. Because those of you who are between the ages of 14 years old and 30 years old, you believe that that age group is the most intelligent on earth, has the most ability to discern, has the most information about how you should do things, and you believe that you are very well set to live life without a pastor's help, without a father's help, without a governor's help. You have got the answers in yourself to live life. Though I know, I've been that age too, and I knew that when I was that age, okay? You don't have to tell me you think that, because I already know you think that, if you're in that age group. If you are an exception to that rule, you're an amazing exception. So when you're in that age group, you look at your pastor and you say, well, now he's wrong about this, and he's wrong about this, and he's wrong about this, and he's wrong about that, but over here, I need his help. So we use him when we need him, and we curse him when we want. When you see little kids, you know, they do the same thing to mom and dad. If they're hungry, mom and dad have the food. If they're tired, mom and dad can read the story and rock them. Mom and dad can put them to bed. Mom and dad can give them the things that they need. Mom and dad can comfort them. But if mom and dad say no about something, then there is a fit. Because I know when I'm 4 years old when is the right time to eat chocolate. My mama doesn't know. Anyway, let's turn to Matthew chapter 12. Let's read the quote from Isaiah 42, talking about Christ. Matthew chapter 12. Verse 18 says, "Behold, my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved, in whom my soul is well pleased." We're talking about Christ here now. "I will put my spirit upon him, and he shall show judgment to the Gentiles. He shall not strive nor cry, neither shall any man hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed shall he not break, and smoking flax shall he not quench, till he send forth judgment unto victory, and in his name shall the Gentiles trust." You know, when a mama is in birth, mama experiences a lot of extreme pain. When a mama is in birth, mama goes through a lot of body functions that she doesn't have any control over to bring the baby to birth. And it hurts. It's not easy. It's very hard work. The baby does not feel that. The baby does not know that mama is working with all of the might that she has, and then some. But the job gets done through the pain of the mother. The job does not get done through the pain of the baby. The job gets done through the pain of the mother. Jesus, speaking of Jesus here, it says, "He shall not strive nor cry, neither shall any man hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed shall he not break, and smoking flax shall he not quench, till he send forth judgment unto victory, and in his name shall the Gentiles trust." We have a picture here of the most mild-mannered man that you can imagine. We have a picture of the most gentlest shepherd that you can imagine, absolutely, utterly accomplishing the job of bringing salvation to the world. Now, I want you to think for a minute. I tried for hours and hours to come up with a good illustration for this subject, and I couldn't. But I could probably have Jason come up here, and he could probably give me one that I've heard, but I don't know a lot about. But I do know that in the auto mechanic world, there are things on your cars that you need a press to put together and or take apart. And I do happen to know from different things that I've heard that you can try doing some of those jobs with a hammer, but not with very good success. Now, the fact of the matter is, when you're using a hammer trying to do something that you need a lot more power to do, you might sometime accomplish it, but you might damage something, and you're going to do a lot of very heavy beating. This is a pastor who doesn't have the power of God, but believes in the righteousness of the New Testament. You see those kind of people every once in a while. They are bullheaded, they are strong, they are absolutely awful to their congregation. They will put out parents because their kids did something wrong, put them out of the church. They all sorts of crazy things you hear pastors do. They've got a hammer. They don't have the ability to actually do the job. But you take that same thing and you put it in a press that was designed to do that job, and with a very, very ease, the press does it without hurting anything at all, because it was designed to do the job. If you stack a pallet with boxes and shrink wrap it and get a pickup truck to move that pallet, we don't know what might happen to it. You might be able to hook a rope to it and you might be able to drag it. It might break, it might tip over, it might crash. Or you could just ram it with the front end and see if you could slide it. And you know, the faster you go, the more likely you are to move it. Or you could get a forklift. And you can just lift it a little bit. And you just drive it exactly where you want it. And when you've got a tool that does the job, it works. Jesus, as we saw two sermons ago, the Bible says about him, he is able to save. Jesus has the ability to take somebody who is a sinner and make them righteous. He has the ability to take somebody who needs help and help them. Both of those are in Hebrews. He is able. And we looked last week where Paul says that he has made us able ministers of the New Testament. But the interesting thing about it is, when something is able, it's also mild. When something is created correctly to do a job, it does it mildly, and effortlessly, and in a proper way. This is a picture of what a pastor is supposed to be. When you are looking at somebody who is leading the people of God, their job, their primary job is to feed people. Their primary job is to help people. Their primary job is to take somebody who's having trouble with the enemy and point them to Christ, where there is deliverance and where there is help. Finding victory for the people of God. But you know what happens because we have this person that we're dealing with now? That is both flesh and spirit, both born of the flesh and born of the spirit. We get resistance. So we're going to try and do a job now that there is resistance to. Now, what do we do as a pastor to actually accomplish forming Christ in God's people? What do we do? A bruised reed shall he not break? And smoking flax shall he not quench, till he send forth judgment unto victory. What we do in that situation is we bear the pain. We, pastors, the leaders, and this does not only apply to pastors, but this could apply to any person in this room who is involved in any way in ministry to anybody. We take on us the trouble. The hammer comes down on our head, not on the part that we are banging on. We carry somebody's burdens. We bear the troubles. We go in prayer to God. We fast. We study the scriptures. We give our lives to God. We learn of Christ to find the answer to man's problems. It's not sometimes super, super, super hard. Sometimes you might spend a life long dealing with a single person, giving them the care that a shepherd would give to his sheep. Jesus, our pattern, the chief shepherd, was a mild person that effortlessly did the job that needed to be done to save people by taking the pain on himself. Now, I have seen a few times, not super many, but I have seen a few times pastors that work on a different basis. More often than not, when pastors are doing things wrong, they do wrong compared to what we're talking about when we're looking at Psalm 23 and Psalm 1 and Psalm 2 and Psalm 8, etc. When they would like to try and shepherd God's people without in any way, shape, or form deal with sin, They want to have the benefit of helping God's people without taking care of the problem that's hurting God's people. That's more often than not what you see wrong in a pastor. But once in a while, you get somebody on the other side who has made it their absolute business, nothing stopping them. They will deal with sin in the lives of all the people who are under their ministry. Them, the people, paying all costs. If somebody's doing wrong, you make them pay for it. If somebody's doing wrong, you chew them out for it. If somebody doesn't listen to you, you kick them out for it. Hard. Always hard on people. That's not what a pastor is. And it doesn't work. But I do believe that in the New Testament we see Christ as an example and his followers giving the same example. That being a pastor sometimes takes patience, love, and a whole pile of other things that is somewhat difficult for the human being to attain. But those things are available because Christ is the one who gives the gifts. And when Christ gives the gift of being a leader, he gives some of his own love, some of his own feelings. You know, I can tell, this is the honest truth. I'm not really much of a pastor. I've been working a little bit at it for a number of years. But I'm not probably looking very good through all my preaching here on what is a pastor. I'm probably not looking like I measure very much up to the standard. But the little bits that I have experienced with it, I can tell you right now, people sitting in these chairs right here, that have been on a list of of people who need to change for years. They've been talked to about things, but they don't listen. They disagree with leadership because they know better. And they have got eyesight that goes about 2.5 inches beyond the end of their nose. Now you forgive me for saying that, but I'm going to say it anyway because it came out of my mouth. Some of you guys have got eyesight that goes about 2.5 inches beyond the end of your nose. And there's other people standing on towers that can see miles away from you and tell you what's ahead, what's on the road ahead of you. But you don't believe them. Because you think their eyesight is the same as yours. And you think what they understand that you don't see, they don't understand. You think they're just all messed up. What do you do with those kind of people if you're a pastor? Feed them. Is that what Jesus said to Peter? Do you love me? He said to Peter. And Peter said, yes, I love you. And Jesus said, feed my sheep. What do you feed them? Do you feed them medicine all the time that will help them to get over their errors? Not necessarily. Medicine is used in small quantities when you're taking care of somebody. Mostly you nourish them with good food. But what if the person who you are nourishing with good food slaps you in the face when you're done? Paul said to the Corinthians that he was going to love them more abundantly in spite of the fact that, and this isn't a quote, but in spite of the fact that the more he loved them, the less he was loved. That's what a pastor does. A pastor is a kind of a person who has to be someone who can't be offended. All of you guys, if you want to, when I'm done preaching tonight, we're going to sit down and eat. And I don't mind if all of you guys want to gather around me. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do. If all of you guys want to gather around me and tell me everything that you know of that's wrong with me. In fact, if you would like to publish a book called The Timothy Konjerski Problems, I don't care if you do that. You can if you want to. Let me add the last chapter. I probably could add some things that nobody even knows about. But at the end of the day, if that's how you feel about me, I don't care. I did not start preaching because I liked what you guys felt about me. That wasn't the reason I started preaching. I started preaching because God told me to. And the fact of the matter is, when I started preaching, I was a sinner, and I'm still a sinner today. And if you guys know some of my sins, then you just know who I am. But the reason that I'm preaching, the reason that I try as much as is in my capabilities, which is total weakness, but the reason that I try to feed God's people is because God told me to. And it doesn't matter what you think about the job I am doing. It really doesn't matter. I have had more people disgruntled with me and upset with me than I have had people who really liked me in my life. But I wasn't preaching for love. I certainly have not ever been preaching for money. There was a guy here one day. He's not here right now. Hasn't been here for years. But there was a guy here one day who, after I preached a sermon that slightly offended him, but was a very biblical sermon, he wrote me a letter. It was about 3 pages long, as I remember. It might have only been 2. And in his letter, he took me to task as hard as a person knows how. He told me that I said ungodly things about God. He told me that I was basically, he said I was lazy and undisciplined and didn't study the word. Obviously I didn't, because I didn't come to the same conclusions about it that he did. So obviously I hadn't studied. But the fact of the matter is I had studied and I had come to the true conclusions, and he held a few false doctrines, and I had stepped on his toes a little bit with my sermon. So he wrote me this letter and said, I'm leaving the church. He said, I can't get along with this. He said, you preached an ungodly sermon and you know, it is slightly depressing to get letters like that. But I called him up and I said, you better come over and talk and tell me just exactly what I did say that was so wrong. Because he didn't detail any of that in his letter. And so he did. So he came over, and so we had a friendly talk for a couple of hours that night. And I asked him point blank when he was sitting there at my table, I asked him, what did I say that was unbiblical? What did I say that was wrong? And after discussion for a couple of hours, the only thing that he said to me in any way that even resembled an apology was, if that's what you meant, I guess it wasn't so bad. He said something of that nature. He never said sorry for any of the things he said in his letter. He never made any apology for raking me over the coals. He never said that I really was a good student of the scriptures or that I knew anything that I was doing. But he said he would come back to church. Now, pastors deal with those kind of people. And you know what pastors do with those kind of people? If they walk with God, they love them. Because Christ loves them. I don't mean they show them love. I mean they actually love them. I mean the same way a mama and a dad love their rotten little 5-year-old who's throwing a temper tantrum on the floor. In that same way the pastor loves the people. Because Christ Jesus has imparted some of himself to that person who is ministering the word of God. And because that person loves Christ, and because Christ loves that person, the pastor loves that person, the pastor's there to feed that person. It doesn't matter what that person does to the pastor. You guys put it down, any of you guys who are sitting here. If there's anybody here, I don't care if you're a girl or a boy, or if you're old or young, or if you're something besides, If you are ever going to be involved in successful ministry where you actually help people through Christ, you are going to have to get to the point with your life that you do not get offended by anything people do to you. You're going to have to understand that you're a sinner just like them. You're going to have to get there. Because you put yourself in a place, in a public place, and you will get lots of irritated people angry at you. Some of the times it will potentially even be your own fault, because pastors aren't perfect people either. They're just leaders. I want you to see what Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 10. You know, as we're reading this passage in Matthew, this quote from Isaiah, Jesus is going to bring judgment to the Gentiles. Jesus is going to bring his righteousness to the Gentiles, okay? He's actually going to make the ungodly, the heathen, he's going to make them righteous. But he's going to do it in a mild manner that only the Son of God could do. Anybody who is involved in ministry is going to have both those sides of dealing in them. They are going to have to be able to be as gentle as the gentlest person on earth and as hard as the hardest person on earth. They're going to have both of those capabilities, and they're going to have to apply to different situations correctly. You know, Paul could write to the Corinthians and he could write the hardest things you could imagine a person saying to them about their sin. And he could tell them exactly what was wrong with them, and he could withhold nothing from them that was profitable, as he says to the Ephesians. But listen to what he writes in chapter 10, 2 Corinthians. Now I, Paul, myself beseech you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, who in presence am base among you, but being absent am bold toward you. But I beseech you that I may not be bold when I am present, with that confidence wherewith I think to be bold against some, which think of us as if we walked according to the flesh. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. I got to stop for just a moment here. I hope you guys are catching this as we go. He's got the meekness and gentleness in Christ in verse 1, and he's got weapons in his hand in verse 4 that are mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. You know, same thing we just read about in Matthew chapter 12. We've got the gentleness of Christ, and we've got the strength of actually accomplishing bringing salvation to the world. Verse 5, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ, and having in a readiness to revenge all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled. Verse 6, he says to the Corinthians, I am ready to revenge all disobedience when you guys get your lives in order. In other words, what he said to the Corinthians was, I have a responsibility to revenge disobedience in the church. But first, let me fix your problem so I don't have to do it on you. That's what he said. And that is a picture of a pastor who has the power of God. Now we have the ability. Now, we have the responsibility to require righteousness in the church, but we have the ability to lead the people into righteousness without beating them up. We have the ability to lead them into righteousness before we put them out of the church. We have the ability, because we are working under the shepherd who died, gave his life, and actually provided victory for human beings. actually provided righteousness for them, or his righteousness that he gives them. But it's more than just his righteousness, because it becomes their own when he gives it to them and they become righteous. They start to become righteous. We have the ability to lead the people of God. In what kind of a manner? Back to Galatians. My little children, of whom I travail in birth again until Christ be formed in you. He had already travailed for the Galatians once. Now he's doing it again. Why? If he had brought these people to Christ and they had turned on him and embraced Judaism and rejected Christ and started keeping the law, how come he didn't go in there and say, well, you guys obviously aren't Christians, and put them out of the church? How come he didn't do that? Because Christ had sent him to feed those people, and he had the ability to feed those people. He had the ability to preach Christ to them. He had the ability to lead them out of their error. But it cost him going through birth to do it. And you know what? He probably did it again for them later. It's not recorded in the scriptures. And if he didn't do it for them, he did it for the next congregation he was working at. And the next, and the next, and the next. And as long as he went on through his life, Paul is experiencing being in labor for the church of God over and over and over and over and over again. It is the call of the church to put sinners out of the church. Okay, it is. If somebody is in the church and they are doing something wrong and they absolutely will not listen to anybody in the church and they've been warned by everybody and it's very evil, it is the responsibility of the church to put them out of the church. But you know how many times you see that happen in the New Testament? Such a small handful, you can hardly get a hold of it. Because we have the ability, we have the power of God to make the people follow Christ. And it is not through putting people out of the church. It is not through abusing people. It is not through being hard on people. It's actually through shepherding with food. It's actually through being gentle. It's being Christ-like and bearing with the people who were born years ago and need to be born again, and who in a few years will need to be born again. Not figuratively speaking, because we're not talking about losing your salvation and getting saved again here. We're talking about just what Paul was talking about when he said, I travail in birth again until Christ be formed in you. He wasn't travailing in birth for them to get them saved that time. He was travailing in birth for Christ to be formed in them. So Paul writes to the Corinthians here. That is his job, and he's ready to do it. He is ready to revenge all the disobedience once their obedience is fulfilled. He went on saying that for the rest of his life about everybody that he dealt with. He went on saying that. I'm ready to revenge disobedience as soon as I can get you guys obedient. But you know what? When the mama takes it upon herself to be in labor and to bear the pain and to go through the work, the baby gets born. When the pastor wants to shrug off the duties of being the kind of a person who walks with God and cares for the people and feeds the people, when he wants to shrug off those duties and he just wants easy work and he wants them to deal with their own problems, we can't do anything then. There's no help for the church. Paul did not sit here and do nothing waiting for their obedience to be fulfilled. He gave his life to work towards it. You know, in the book of Philemon, Paul is a prisoner. Onesimus is a servant. Onesimus is Philemon's servant. He runs away from Philemon, and he ends up by Paul, probably in prison with Paul. Not sure on that. But he ends up by Paul, and he ends up taking care of Paul in prison for a little while. And Paul writes to Philemon, and he says to him, I'm returning your servant to you. He's not just a servant anymore, he's a brother. In other words, I've preached the gospel to this guy, and he's gotten saved. Now he's coming back to you, not only as your servant, but also as a brother. And Paul says, if Onesimus owes you, Philemon, if he owes you anything, put that on my account. Now wait a minute, Paul. If Philemon is a lord that has servants, he's a wealthy guy. Okay? He's no poor man. Now Paul, you read the things Paul writes about himself. He's hungry all the time. He's naked all the time. He's without this, that, and the other thing. He is living in absolute poverty, and he's in prison. Now, how is Paul going to pay back anything that Onesimus did wrong to Philemon? That doesn't matter. When you become the leader of a person like Jesus is, that's what you do. It doesn't matter to you anymore how you're going to do things, you just do things because you do. Paul is going to personally take on himself the responsibility of making anything right between Philemon and Onesimus. And he writes to Onesimus, or to Philemon rather, and he says, basically, I'm not quoting now because I'm just going off my memory of the story. He basically says, you know, Philemon, you owe yourself to me. Because Philemon is also one of Paul's converts. Philemon also got saved through Paul's ministry. And Paul says, you owe your own self to me anyway. And maybe it would be that you would be interested in sending Onesimus back here to help me. But he says, that's none of my business. I'm going to let you make that decision. Basically, that's what he said. This is how you take and fix things that are otherwise unfixable. By taking the load onto yourself that nobody else is willing to bear. That's what Jesus did on the cross. He took on him the sins of the world that nobody else could bear. He took on him the guilt of everything that everybody else on earth ever did wrong. He took it and he bore it. Those of you who are young in your Christian faith may can't even totally understand the depth of that. We like to fight for our rights. If somebody does us wrong, we want them to fix it. We want them to make something wrong. We want them to make their wrongs right. If somebody has stolen from us, we feel like they owe us something. But Jesus didn't feel that way when he was standing up in heaven. And he looked down over all the earth, billions and billions and billions of people. They had all wronged each other and they had all wronged God. And Jesus had absolutely no blame whatsoever for any of it. All he had ever done was been good to them. He had sent them his son. He had sent them his rain. He had fed them. He had clothed them. All of their lives, God had given good things to every man, though they were sinners. And he decided up in heaven, although none of the problems that anybody had were his personal problem, he would pay for them anyway. Because he loved them. When you become a pastor, you enter into that same understanding of people. People's problems are my problem. I'll take care of them. I will join Christ in bearing the load of humanity's problems. It can actually be a crushing job. For people who get into ministry, it can be a crushing job. And you know, humans are humans, and there's only so much a human being can bear. And I have seen some people trying to be that kind of a person in the work of God, and they just burn out. They lose heart. They lose ability. They lose everything. They feel like they can't go on. They wear themselves out because all they ever do is get used by people. Just get used, get used, get used. There's no input anywhere. Does anybody think that that maybe sounds just a little bit like death? You know, if you're in that situation where you feel like the only thing that people do to you is use you and you can't handle it, then you're just not quite in the situation yet where Jesus was when he gave his life for the sins of the world. And we have to constantly seek to God for more of his face to help us keep going. Because Jesus did not say to Peter, "Do you love the sheep? Feed them." He said to Peter, "Do you love me?" And when Peter said yes, he said, "Feed my sheep." Because the fact of the matter is, if we tried to feed the people of God based on our love for them, it wouldn't be as great as feeding them based on our love for Christ. That is a pastor. And we will dismiss for tonight.